the latest on what's happening in Haiti, a look at how local leaders are planning to tackle climate change and the environment, and two South Florida colleges deal with changes in their athletic departments. This is the South Florida Roundup. I'm Lance Dixon, filling in for Tom Hudson. It's been more than 4 months since Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, and since then, the country has continued to deal with the fallout from his death, a massive earthquake, storms, and ongoing gang violence. We discuss the latest. Also on the show, we'll discuss how South Florida leaders are looking to combat climate change. We'll talk with some local reporters and advocates about those plans and takeaways from recent local and international climate summits. Plus, big shakeups at two college athletic programs. What does the future look like at UM and FIU? All that, plus your calls, coming up on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. I'm Lance Dixon, filling in for Tom Hudson. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Haiti continues to struggle to find stable footing, even 4 months since Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated. A massive earthquake rocked the island in August, causing thousands of deaths. Then came Tropical Storm Grace. And in recent months, gang violence and a kidnapping of an aid group have added to fears for safety for Haitians and their families and friends right here in South Florida. U.S. officials have continued efforts to send aid and support. U.S. diplomat Todd Robinson spelled out some of the details of that assistance in a recent conversation with WLRN.
It's going to take significant investment on the part of the United States and the international community. My bureau has committed to help the Haitian National Police stand up a force to take back their country.
And in the past week, there was also an additional arrest in the Moïse assassination case as that investigation continues. Local groups have continued efforts to get supplies and assistance to people on the island, even amid the instability. We want to hear from you, South Florida, about all of this. Do you have loved ones or friends in Haiti? Have you been able to keep in touch with them? And what role do you think the U.S. should play? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to share your thoughts. You can also reach us on Twitter. We're at WLRN. Tim Padgett is WLRN's America's editor. He's joining us to talk about some of this, along with Marlene Bastien, the executive director of the Family Action Network Movement, and Sandra Dennis, the executive director of the Miami Worker Center. Tim, we'll start off with you. What's the latest on the U.S. response in the country?
Well, as you pointed out, we talked with Ambassador Todd Robinson. His new portfolio now is he's Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the State Department. And as such, their job now, and it's probably one of the most challenging in the hemisphere, as you know, is to help rebuild public security in Haiti, particularly rebuild the effectiveness of the Haitian National Police so that it can confront the gangs, which essentially, if you talk to most Haitians, as I've been doing over the past few weeks, they will simply say the gangs are more powerful than the actual government authority right now in Haiti. So he has a real daunting task to rebuild the police, rebuild public order so that they can hold eventually elections to create a new government presence that would be, you know, more authoritative than the gangs.
Sure, sure. And to that point, Tim, you know, how are folks on the island, you know, how are they seeing that presence? Is that presence even appearing to them in a real way, or how are things looking?
No, and one of the big messages, you know, I would ask them, well, if you could talk to Ambassador Robinson, what would you tell him? And they would say, look, the government people that you're working with, all the way from interim Prime Minister Ariel Henry down to senators and Congress people and other officials, they're essentially saying, if you want to engage the government to help rebuild public security and the police, you really can't be dealing with a lot of these political elites because they themselves are involved with the gangs in Haiti as sort of, you know, they're enforcers and things of that nature. So that's the dilemma that Robinson is facing, and that's what I hear from so many Haitians I've been talking to.
Gotcha, yeah. And again, you know, we mentioned this earlier, that group, the aid workers with that missionary group, Christian Aid Ministries, do we know anything more about where things stand with that?
All we know is that both Haitian and U.S. officials, including the FBI, are still in some sort, we really don't know the details, but some sort of negotiations with the leaders of the gang that kidnapped those missionary workers. It's known as 400 Masawo or 400 Mawoso. And the only thing news we've had in the past couple of weeks is that 400 Mawoso reportedly provided some proof of life of these 17 American and Canadian hostages. But that's really all we know at this point.
Gotcha. Yeah. Marlon, I want to bring you in now into the conversation and thank you for joining us. What have you been hearing from folks, on the island in the past few months or even in recent weeks?
Oh, well, thank you for having me, and I'm pleased to be here with Sandra and other folks. What I've been hearing is that the country is basically in lockdown. As a result of the fuel shortage, people are sequestrated at home. They are not able to go to the market to attend to their daily lives. The kidnapping is still wreaking havoc in people's lives, and both Haitians, locals, and international folks, as we know, are not spared. Schools have been out for months now, and we've been getting calls from Haiti asking for help because the country is in lockdown. The Haitians are now believed to be refugees in their own home because those who live in Martissant, for example, they've fled their homes and they are living in shelters really in terrible conditions. So the situation is really, really horrible right now on the island.
Gotcha. Yeah. Sandra, I also want to bring you into this. I know that, in your main role, you lead the Miami Workers Center and a lot of different focuses for that organization here locally. But what can you tell me about what you're hearing about how people are just trying to respond to what's happening with Haitians on the island?
Thank you, Lance. Again, it's a privilege to be here with such a powerhouse, Marlon Bastien, for our community here locally and I would say throughout this country. I think this is an interesting conversation happening after what November 18th yesterday represents for the Haitian community, the Battle of Vetier, which was like the last battle of the Haitian Revolution. And for us, the Haitian people are desperate for a fight, right? They need, they're calling out to us. I'm on Twitter, I'm talking to people who are on the island, are in Haiti, and they're saying the situation is dire. They're asking us to share out with our elected officials, with our Congress folks, that SOS. They can't, again, to Marlon's point, they cannot get gas. They're basically locked down in their homes. They cannot, get to their daily activities. School, hospitals are being shut down because of a lack of gas. Again, there's a lot of, violence specifically towards, what's happening with gangs and people feeling, and not necessarily feeling, but being unsafe in the country. And Lance, I would always, want to elevate the conversation to, there's assistance being offered. Is it the assistance that the people, civil societies, the young activists on the ground, is that what they say they need?
Sure.
And I think we have to reconcile that.
Definitely, yeah. And to that point, we have a caller, Ian in Lauderhill, joining us. Ian, you're on South Florida Roundup.
I'd like to thank you guys. Hi to everyone. My comment is more of a comment than any. We don't want help from the U.S. in a sense. What we want the U.S. to do is to number one, acknowledge that they're making us pay for taking our freedom and changing an economic system in 1804. And the second thing is, we need to ask ourselves, all these weapons, when they're traced back, they're coming from the U.S. How are all these weapons, which are brand new, getting to Haiti, and why? Who does it benefit? We know it benefits the bourgeoisie. We know it benefits some people in the government, but it also benefits the U.S. because the more chaos there is in Haiti, the more they can try to get to our minds. We understand what's going on. So the comment I'm making is, we don't want money. We don't want weapons. We don't need the U.S. to intervene in our business. What we want the U.S. to do is to first acknowledge they're wrong, what they've been doing is wrong, and to leave us alone. That's what we want.
Ian, we appreciate you sharing those thoughts with us. Tim, to that point, the U.S. involvement is obviously something that's tenuous. They're trying to negotiate all these things. So what is your response to that?
Right. He brings up a really great point about the guns and ammunition, which are being smuggled into Haiti so rampantly right now. And that's what's really fueling the gang presence, the gang control, really, of large swaths of the country. And when I talk to Haitians, that is really one of the main things they bring up is, you know, we don't necessarily want U.S. troops here, but can't the U.S. do something to cut off the flow of those guns? I mean, we're talking about, you know, AK-47s and high caliber weapons of that nature. They really feel that Ambassador Robinson, for example, should make that a priority. Because without those guns, the gangs become, you know, much more weakened, and they can't do those kinds of activities like the ransom kidnappings, and most important, they wouldn't be able to recruit more youth in Haiti.
Gotcha. Once again, I'm Lance Dixon here filling in for Tom Hudson. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup. We're chatting with Tim Padgett, our America's editor here at WLRN, Marlon Bastien, the executive director of the Family Action Network Movement, and Sandra Dennis, the executive director of the Miami Workers Center, talking about Haiti and just the latest that's happening there in the country. Marlon, I want to bring you back in just to talk about, you know, we're hearing a lot about how things are going on the island, but how is the diaspora here in South Florida kind of dealing with all of this news and just seeing things like, you know, there were the migrants that made their way to the Florida Keys yesterday and just the constant updates, but not really knowing necessarily, you know, how they can best intervene there.
Yeah, so thank you again. So, you know, Haitians are very resilient. We are known to be very resilient folks. We've endured dictatorships, constitutional crises, coup d'etats, food insecurity, pandemics, natural disasters, the assassination of our own president, for God's sake. But for the first time, Lance, in recent history, I hear a lot of hopelessness, and that really, that's hurting, because after the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse and then after the Del Rio event, people went to different emotions. It was shock and disbelief to see this border patrol in huge horses chasing, you know, Haitians in this century, and then that turned into anger, and then people were infuriated by the fact that the Haitian people have always stood by the U.S. I mean, if there is a wealthy United States of America, a thriving United States of America, the richest countries in the world, Haitians played a big part. And the Haitians have always stood by the U.S. And the people now seem to feel like they are let down, like they cannot trust this country to do anything. And then there's a lot of anxiety. We've been getting at FAM, Family Action Network Movement, for example, we've been getting a lot of calls to our social workers about people not able to sleep, not only about what's going on in Haiti, but also here. Because believe it or not, on the 16th of this month, you know, a plane landed in Haiti. Even while the U.S. is advising, you know, its nationals to leave Haiti because Haiti is too dangerous, and yet the U.S. is deporting men, women, and children, over 10,000 since September, in a country that is in lockdown, where children cannot go to school, where women and girls as young as 5 years old are targeted for kidnapping and rape. And we know that in situations of turmoil and high instability, women and girls fare worse. So people are, you know, they go through different emotions, some shock, disbelief, anger, hopelessness, and I've been organizing on the ground for 40 years, and I've never seen this high level of anxiety. And I can tell you that these calls keep our case managers, you know, busy. Actually, we realize that we have to build capacity, because not only that they are for the first time in history, Lance, and I don't know if you really realize that, I know, Sandra, you're also aware of that, for the first time, and I've never seen this before, the refugees are being released without alien numbers. Unknown, completely unknown. And then when all case managers assist them, they are given interviews and appointments for next year. So what are they supposed to do? So to make it short, I've never seen such a high level of anger and combined with anxiety and stress.
And that's particularly notable, as you mentioned, just the many years and decades that you've dedicated to this work. Sandra, I'm curious from your perspective. I know that in the local community, you interact a lot with younger Haitian Americans, younger members of the diaspora, millennials, things like that. Are you hearing similar sentiments from them that they're just unsure of where to turn or feeling a sense of hopelessness?
Right. I think, at least for me, I think many Haitian young folks started going back to Haiti and traveling on a regular basis quite often, actually 2 and 3 times a year, let's say in the last decade. And even as things started to deteriorate, there was still an acknowledgement that our parents want to retire in Haiti. They want to go home. Mm-hmm. They want to, you know, be by the beach. And so for us, it's like reconciling our parents and our loved ones. They're heartbroken that, you know, their retirement hopes was still in Haiti. And what does that mean for our generation and having to figure out how our parents age in place here in a country that, you know, they was hoping to work and then be able to retire somewhere else. I think the other thing that I also want to lift up is that for sure there's a lot of disappointment. There's a lot of hurt. You know, it's heartbreaking to see what we've seen and to hear what we're hearing. I also want to acknowledge, you know, young activists on the ground in Haiti who are nonstop, you know, sharing their truth, speaking truth to power, raising the alarm in terms of what they're experiencing. And these are folks who have, you know, dedicated their, while they're young, their lives to staying in Haiti, to seeing that, you know, corruption, impunity, all the things that, you know, result in what we're seeing right now is done away with. And so I still feel fired up. They remind us not to give up because they are there. Haiti, no one's going to save Haiti. It's us, right? And so we're seeing that. And the true reality, to Marlon's point, that we're alone. And we've known this, but it's also shocking, specifically when folks have considered themselves to be allies, in quotation, friends. But I'm still fired up, and I still believe that we have a revolutionary spirit. And I think there's a generation who wants Haiti, both here and in Haiti, to thrive. And the question is, how do we get there?
Sure, okay. Sure. I want to hear from one more caller really quickly, if we can. Nahum in Miami, you're on their air. Go for it.
Hi, thank you for taking me. My call is really directed to Sam Padgett. I'd like you please to address the role of the United States in the Haitian crisis. Because since 1915 and for the past few decades, they have been organizing elections to put their own people, and they've been supporting them. For example, they've been supporting the PHTK. This regime in power, they have been killed, they have been raped, they have been killing, and yet the U.S. is still supporting them. So basically, the U.S. owns this crisis in Haiti. I'm wondering why you never, Sam Padgett, address the role of the United States in the Haitian crisis. You don't have only to address the enemies of the United States in the region. So whenever you have your report, it's always about the enemies of the United States. I've never heard you talking about the PHTK, how they raped, killed, and yet they're supporting them.
All right, Nahum, we appreciate that. Tim, how do you...
Well, Nahum, I'd like you to give your email to one of our people here so that I could send you some of the commentaries that I've been writing over the past year, in which I do take on the United States, including Democrats as well as Republicans, President Biden as well as President Trump, in terms of what you're talking about. I don't disagree with you, and I think you raise a great point. One of the big criticism, for example, of Hillary Clinton was that this whole crisis, perhaps in some some ways started an entire decade ago when, after the earthquake, she for some reason sanctioned the election of a very controversial Haitian president, Michel Martelly, who went about essentially dismantling a lot of the democratic institutions in Haiti, including the national police. And then his successor was Jovenel Moïse, who himself was not really that much of a friend to democracy. And yet the Biden administration sort of looked the other way, as he said he wanted to extend his presidential term for another year, which may not have been constitutional. So, yes, I agree with you, Nahum. I think the United States does have a lot of complicity to answer for when we look at how this present crisis sort of got generated a decade ago, really after the chaos of the earthquake in 2010.
Thank you for that, Tim. We'll probably just have to leave it there, unfortunately, for today. But I want to thank you for sharing your reporting with us, Marlene. Thank you for sharing all of your expertise and knowledge and those really, you know, just heartfelt recollections from what you're hearing. And Santra as well will be sticking around with us for our next conversation. So thank you to all of you.
Thank you, Lance.
Thank you.
Still to come, we'll be discussing local plans to address climate change, and we want to hear from you, 800-743-WLRN, 800-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Lance Dixon, filling in for Tom Hudson. Emissions, our waterways, rising seas, extreme heat. All of these things are part of the larger story of the climate crisis and how it impacts us here in South Florida. Officials continue to identify plans and set goals for reducing the man-made factors in our changing climate, but some of those proposals are already falling short. Ideas for addressing these impacts of climate change are all in play, and especially so after the recent United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow, and a recent workshop hosted by the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. But questions remain. Can these ambitious goals be met? Will there be funding? And will there be the political will to make it happen? We're going to be talking about climate change, and we want to hear from you. Are you seeing efforts from your local leaders to address these issues? How are you thinking about these environmental threats and the plans to either fix or reduce some of the harms that they can cause? Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or reach out to us on Twitter. You can do that at WLRN. My guests joining me are Alex Harris, who covers climate change for the Miami Herald, Danny Rivero, a reporter and producer for us here at WLRN, and Santra Dennis is sticking around with us from the previous conversation. She is the executive director of the Miami Workers Center. Alex, what can you tell us about this latest carbon neutrality plan and climate change plan that the city of Miami approved?
So yesterday, the city of Miami unanimously approved the Miami Forever Carbon Neutral Plan. So that means the city has a strategy on how it's going to commit to getting rid of all emissions in the city by 2050. And it has a halfway goal of 2030. It wants to cut out 60% of emissions. And a lot of that is stuff, you know, we've heard before. It's a lot more solar panel in buildings. It's convincing people to use public transportation. It's making buildings more efficient. And it's switching out all of the city's fleet of like buses and cop cars to electric vehicles.
Gotcha. And as you've reported, this plan is a bit more watered down than a previous proposal that was announced on Earth Day and had a lot of ambitious goals. And so what can you tell us about how we got to this version and sort of what changed?
Gotcha. So yeah, the city of Miami has been working on a strategy on how it's going to approach cutting its emissions for more than a year. The very beginning of this year in February, we saw some really ambitious plans. The city was like, okay, how about we tackle natural gas, which makes up a really small but important portion of the emissions of the city. And they said, you know, we're considering making it so that new construction in the future isn't allowed to hook up to natural gas, or that buildings that run on natural gas for using like heat or in their stoves are required to convert over to electricity at a certain point. And I reported earlier this week that it looks like the city was actually heavily influenced from February till about April by natural gas company TECO. And after some lobbying from that company, the city changed its plan to get rid of a lot of, to water down some of those strategies and make it so that the company could continue doing business in this city. And then we saw the final draft plan yesterday, and it watered down even further. And that was more from some state legislature that's happened and controlled the way we're allowed to manage energy in every city.
Gotcha. And to that point, Danny, I want to bring you in now. Can you tell us a little bit more about the role that the state government's played in this plan?
Right. So as Alex mentioned, the city of Miami was discussing the potential of regulating new construction, which is one of the very few areas where the city actually has the power to regulate, right? Like the city can't regulate how FPL is generating energy, but they have the control of the buildings that are being constructed. So the city was having conversations about basically cutting off natural gas connections to buildings that are going to be built in the future. And then over time, that will bring down the amount of carbon that's burned. So what happened was there was a similar proposal that came out of Tampa, which was actually very strongly worded. And after that proposal came out in Tampa, the state legislature passed a pair of bills in Tallahassee, which prohibited any city, any county from banning these natural gas hookups. So as a result of that, it's a big part of why the city of Miami is not able to reach some of the goals that they were saying that they wanted to reach for reducing emissions. Some of it was, as Alex mentioned, heavy lobbying and pressure from the natural gas company itself. But some of this is actually this coming from the state government.
Gotcha. So we're talking about these ambitious goals and some of the challenges and obstacles in reaching them. And Sandra, I want to bring you back into the conversation here because you were at COP26 in Glasgow. And I'm curious, just what can you tell us about your experience there and some of your takeaways from it?
Absolutely. Again, thank you again, Lance. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I think that when I hear numbers like 2050, it reminds me that there are communities across the world, frontline communities from the United States of America, folks from the Amazon, indigenous communities from wherever you can think of, who are saying they're feeling the impact of climate change right now. Like when it rains in their communities, homes get washed away, they can't deal with the flooding. We're talking about climate refugees as it relates to Haiti. And what we're hearing is that the solutions are very watered down. There's net zero that's not actually zero emissions. We're hearing an increase in militarization at the border, seeing climate change as a national security issue versus an issue that we should get in front of right now. So there was a lot of base building organizing of grassroots organizations. That was the joyful part of COP. And ultimately, we're very disappointed at the final result because we know that the communities who will be impacted most will be our communities that look like us, Black communities, immigrant communities, who actually are not doing most of the polluting of our world and warming of our world. And so I'll say one more thing, Lance.
Sure.
There was a climate advocate from Nigeria was just talking about, you know, Africa being on the equator can't afford to get hotter. You know, he's like, we will explode, we will combust. And, you know, I that resonated with me so much. We're in Florida. We've had record heat. You know, it flooded yesterday in Miami, in downtown Miami. We don't have to 2050. And so, again, that was what came up. And again, I'm here clear. That is my message moving forward. We got to do something about it right now. We got to really ensure that our government gets it.
Absolutely. Yes, Sandra, thank you for sharing those takeaways with us. Sandra Dennis, the executive director of the Miami Worker Center, joining us. Also, Alex Harris, who covers climate change for the Miami Herald. Danny Rivero, reporter and producer here for us at WLRN. Again, I'm Lance Dixon, filling in for Tom Hudson. This is the South Florida Roundup. And we want to hear from you as we continue this conversation on the climate change. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or tweet at us. At WLRN. So moving a little bit back to South Florida here, Alex, I know that you also recently reported on an initiative in Little River where they're moving about 40 homes from septic tanks to sewer lines. Can you tell us a little more about that county project?
Absolutely. So if you live in South Florida, especially if you have a septic tank, which more than 100,000 people in Miami-Dade County do, you might know that as waters are rising with sea level rise, it's compromising the drainage of those septic tanks. And when it floods from the very mildest, you could be sending pollution into Biscayne Bay all the way up to you're having trouble flushing your toilet or using your bath or shower, and it could come backing up into your house. And some of those lowest lying properties that are most at risk are actually in Little River. And like Sandra was saying earlier, we don't have until 2050. This is something that's happening right now. And the county is under some pressure from residents, from the state, from federal government to clean up its act and connect more people from those pollution and health hazard septic tanks to county sewer lines. And recently, the county announced that it's got a project happening in Little River, connecting about 40 homes from septic tanks to sewage at the cost of about $14 million. And that's helped along with a state grant from the Department of Environmental Protection. And that's helping some of the poorer homeowners. It's helping some homeowners whose tanks are most at risk. And it is a big step forward for the county, who hasn't done many of these conversions in a while.
Gotcha. And speaking of just water and all those sorts of things, there was an announcement from the governor, Ron DeSantis, about $500 million for state wastewater projects. But none of that funding looks to be coming to South Florida. So do we know what factored into that decision when our region is obviously, you know, ground zero for a lot of these issues and a lot of this wastewater treatment that still needs to be dealt with?
Yeah, absolutely. And what a shame. The $500 million could have gone pretty far. I mean, it's going to a lot of valuable projects all around the state, a lot of septic to sewer conversions. But if you looked at the map of where the state was showing where all this money went, none of it appeared in any of the three counties in South Florida, despite all of us having very well-documented historical issues with wastewater. And when we asked the state about that, they said, oh, it's because we didn't give any money to cities or counties that didn't have a specific type of basin management plan, which basically is like, oh, we commit to not polluting Biscayne Bay or whatever their water body is. So when we asked the county about it, Miami-Dade County, they said it was disappointing to them because they put forward almost $240 million worth of projects, and they were hoping to convert a ton more septic tanks in some of the lowest lying areas. So it looks like the county's decided to go another option, try to find some other way to get that money and do some better projects with it, and, you know, still keep on the path of converting from septic to sewer, but just without that state pot of money.
Gotcha. Talking about county projects and shifting goals and ideas, Danny, you recently had a story that looked at some tree planting efforts here in Miami-Dade County, and there was a big push a few years ago to plant some more trees in an effort to combat the extreme heat that we know that South Florida faces so often. But from your reporting, that effort didn't quite reach its goals, did it?
Right. Well, it's not at the end part of the goal making. So the goal is to basically, there's about 20% of Miami-Dade County right now that's covered by tree canopy. And the goal is for 2030 to reach 30%. But it's been 5 years since this project started, and there's been statistically basically no progress. And that's not to say that trees have not been being planted. There are some areas of the county, especially the northeast parts of the county, where there's a lot of new green space being created. But when taken as a whole, the county is actually just stagnant. And a lot of that is because of rampant development. There's new parking lots going up in previously green areas. There's new buildings being constructed. And the data shown by this study that I was reporting on actually shows, it zeroes in on a few areas where when these green spaces are paved over, it gets significantly hotter, like 15 degrees hotter in some areas. And so this is an overall plan from the county, almost as a resilience part to try to help people get through the hottest parts of the year, because it is going to continue to get hotter and hotter. And there's also another part to this, which speaks to the floods that we just saw yesterday, for example.
Sure, folks trying to get to the Heat game last night, for example, yeah.
Right, so we're seeing increasing flooding, and all the projected models we have for climate change is that we're going to continue to see increased flooding, not just from the rising tides, but from storms and just regular storms. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. The ground table is rising. But a big part of planting trees is that actually trees absorb stormwater. So this is actually also part of a plan to help the community better be able to deal with increased floods that we're going to be seeing. Because if we pave everything over, there's nowhere for the water to go. So we see a lot more flooding. So that's part of what the county is doing. They still have the 30% goal by 2030, and we're expecting to see more and more of that happening.
For sure. And Sandra, just want to check back in with you as well. You know, I know that you shared that there was a lot of disappointment coming out of COP26. A lot of folks who were there sort of speaking up and organizing, saying that they they wish that things had shaped out differently or that more voices were potentially represented. But what are some of the takeaways from it that you're actually encouraged by as you return here to South Florida and continue that work?
And I think that there are communities all throughout the world that are, resisting, that are, their livelihoods are protecting our waters and protecting our land. That also I am, I was really reminded that many of us come from communities that do have relationships with the land, that we understand that we can't overwork the land. And I'm excited to be, to take this back home to Miami Worker Center, because when I think about my Haitian mommies and poppies, from people from South America, Central America, people that we organize with, they get it, and I left COP understanding, and there was a Native American, person who said to us, it is the people who live the simplest, who understand how to live simply, who would last what's to come. And it's what we see during the storms, who can plant and harvest, who have the mango trees and the food in their backyards, who can build fires. These are they're going to be survival skills that we need to have, because it will come, and we are a coastal county and we need to act like we are. And so I'm excited that, while I may not be ready for what's to come, I know I have aunties and uncles who are ready, who can help us get there. And we're going to have to figure that out if the government doesn't necessarily put things in place to ensure that we get in front of it for 2023, 2025, and not, speaking this 2050 language.
Sure. Just getting back to that real sense of community that often comes up in these situations with extreme weather. Thank you for sharing that, Santra. Santra Dennis, the executive director of the Miami Worker Center, appreciate you spending your time chatting with us about all of this and your takeaways from COP26. And Danny and Alex, you'll actually be able to hear some more of their reporting in an upcoming episode of WLRN's Tallahassee Takeover podcast, where they'll be looking a lot at this natural gas situation and the state's role and so forth. So stay tuned for that, and be sure to subscribe via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Again, Danny, Alex, thanks to both of you for sharing your reporting today.
Thanks for having us, Lance.
Thanks.
I'm Lance Dixon, here on the South Florida Roundup, filling in for Tom Hudson. And still to come, big changes in two local college athletic departments. You can call us and tune into the show, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Lance Dixon, filling in for Tom Hudson. Sports are a huge part of our community here in South Florida, and especially college sports. The University of Miami has found a great amount of success in college football, baseball, and basketball. Florida International University hasn't quite reached those heights, but they've definitely won some notable games. Those glory days, though, have been overshadowed by a lot of disappointment in the past few years. And that's played out recently in some major changes and departures. The University of Miami fired their athletic director, FIU's athletic director resigned, and the head football coach is on his way out at that program. So even beyond the field and the court, we know that these programs are major profit generators for these universities. And so we'll be discussing how are these changes going to impact, respectively, one of the most storied athletic programs in the country and one of the largest schools in our region. Let us know how you're feeling about the changes at these schools. Are you an alumni? Or are you just a fan of these programs? Whatever the case may be, let us know your thoughts. Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or you can tweet us at WLRN. Joining me now to talk about the latest is David Wilson. He is a sports reporter at the Miami Herald. David, thanks for joining.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
So David, where do things stand right now with UM?
With UM, obviously the athletic director fired on Monday, and they've got to move pretty quickly here. Obviously the regular season ends. We're, I guess, 8 days away from the last game of the regular season. We're talking on Friday now. Miami closes out on the Saturday after Thanksgiving. And, obviously nothing is finalized yet, but the assumption, I think, around all the entire college football world is that there's going to be a coaching change there with Manny Diaz. heading into probably his final couple games here as coach. I think that's just the prevailing sentiment. And they got to move quickly because college football moves quickly. They got to find an athletic director probably basically by the time the regular season ends, because you've got, obviously there's a big coaching carousel this year with LSU job open, USC job open, Washington job open, a couple of major jobs are open this year. And then recruiting obviously never sleeps. And with the early signing period, players can start locking in on December 15th. I think that's the day, whatever that Wednesday is, that week is the date that players can start signing with their colleges. And Miami's basically got to know what they're doing. I think basically by then, or you really set yourself back. It has not been obviously a good couple of years for the program. And, I think there's a lot of urgency from particularly the alumni of the university. They held a round table up in Broward, Miami Lakes, I think last night, which a couple of our reporters attended. I wasn't there, just basically to kind of vent and rant about the program. There's a lot of urgency from some of the people with money around the program for them to get serious, for lack of a better word.
Sure.
They obviously are serious to a certain degree, but there's an urgency for them to really try to make a run at being an elite program again.
Definitely.
And that the new athletic director is going to have to be someone who's got that aggressive vision.
Right, right. And so Blake James, who was the athletic director that was fired and had been there for quite a long time, do we know, you talked about the timetable, so is there a search process underway right now for Blake James's replacement?
Yeah, they've retained a search firm, which a lot of these colleges do, kind of like a CYA kind of thing, right? I think there's a sense, these athletic director searches, some of them take a long time. I remember when Tennessee hired Danny White away from UCF, it took 3 days from the time they let their athletic director go. So it can move quickly, and I think that by the end of the regular season, if not maybe a couple days after the regular season ends, because some of these, if they're trying to poach an athletic director from another school, maybe they'll wait until their regular season is over to like finalize it. But I think by the week after Thanksgiving, there'll be a new guy in place.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And you mentioned that there was this meeting of these alum of the University of Miami where they were kind of venting out their frustrations. So what are you hearing, I guess, just from either alum, people in the community, or even students, just about how they're feeling about this shakeup at a major athletic program like this? I mean, these programs bring a lot of attention and yeah, dollars to these schools.
Yeah, I think there was kind of a feeling with Blake James that it was kind of time, right? He's done a lot of good, and people have obviously, the dregs of social media and all that have been, kind of dancing on his grave over the last, 36, 72 hours. But he's done a lot of good. The Jim Larrañaga hire at basketball kind of revitalized that basketball program in a lot of ways. Basketball has been in a rough couple years here when they got caught up in the FBI investigation, but that was a good hire. Getting Mark Richt to come back to Miami. Obviously he ended up retiring. We found out later he's, dealing with Parkinson's now, so I had some health issues.
Sure.
That was a really good hire. He got the indoor practice facility built. I think even Manny Diaz in a lot of ways has done a couple of good things just to kind of bridge the gap between Mark Richt, who I think kind of stabilized the program, and maybe then whoever the next guy is that's going to come in and try to elevate it. But again, it was just kind of time, football, they had a pretty good year last year, but ended not super well. This is going to be 2 out of 3 years where they're not going to win more than 7 games in the regular season. Basketball hasn't made the NCAA tournament in 3 years now. And the COVID year was in there, but they weren't going to make the tournament that year either.
Yeah.
Even the women's team hasn't made it in a couple of years. The baseball team, which is, a really proud program, hasn't made it out of the first weekend of the NCAA tournament in quite some time, missed the tournament a couple of years, and back-to-back years a few years ago. Women's tennis, they had a girl the last couple of years, Estela Perez Somarriva, who was a national champion, but the athletic department is kind of stagnated. There hasn't been a lot of success over the last 3 or 4 years. Obviously it's always, what have you done for me lately? And I think there was just kind of a consensus that things needed to change. And whatever was currently working, like I said, across the athletic department it's been a little underwhelming. And so I think there was kind of this sense that it was time. And, you know, football, it's been 20 years since they were like a national power.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, there's just obviously it feels like every 4 or 5 years people lose patience. So it's kind of inevitable. And with Blake James in particular, you know, he hired Manny Diaz within 12 hours of Mark Richt retiring. You know, he didn't really do a national search of any kind. So he kind of tied himself to him there. And there were reasons to think that hire was going to maybe work out. You know, they'd been to the Orange Bowl 2 years earlier. Manny obviously knew the players, knew the program. It was kind of a stability move.
Sure.
You know, he's from Miami. His dad was the mayor. Like, there were a lot of reasons to think that maybe it could work out. But he tied himself.
And when you say Manny Diaz,
didn't work out,
the head coach of the football team, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, no, I mean, definitely has been some tough moments for the University of Miami's football team. We'll see how things shake out for them when their season closes out next Saturday, as you mentioned. Again, talking with David Wilson, sports reporter here at the Miami Herald. If you have thoughts about the University of Miami, college football programs in general, et cetera, you can reach us 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So we're shifting gears now from the University of Miami to another big university down here, FIU, that's also had some changes in its athletic department. Can you just walk us through some of the latest there as well?
Yeah, so it kind of all goes back to when FIU beat Miami. I would say that's kind of like the beginning of the end, weirdly. Since then, they've lost 16 of 17 games. They haven't beaten another FBS team since. Which is, you know, the highest level of Division I football. And last week, Pete Garcia, who's been a longtime athletic director, resigns. And, you know, I think the writing had been on the wall for Coach Butch Davis, who, of course, was a legendary national championship winning coach, or national, at least set up the national championship era there at Miami. Writing had been on the wall for him for a little while. But really the last straw there, it's not even necessarily about the wins and losses. And, you know, obviously that matters because it affects everything. But the last straw there is realignment in college football. And they're in Conference USA now. And in the next couple of years, Conference USA might not exist. With, you know, a lot of the schools have gotten poached by the American Athletic Conference, which is right now where, like, UCF, USF, you know, the slightly more established football programs play. FAU, who's kind of lapped FIU as a program, and obviously they're arch rivals, like the Shula Bowl every year, you know, located, what, 50, 60 miles apart, something
sure,
like that,
sure.
Recruiting the same talent base. You know, they're going to the American Athletic Conference. FIU, as of now, is kind of stuck in this Conference USA that is a shell of itself right now, or at least looking like a shell of itself. And, you know, the wins and losses obviously played into that, but that is ultimately where this comes from. FIU is kind of in danger of not being an FBS program in 3 or 4 years because of where they sit right now in the conference landscape.
Wow. So that would be a pretty major shift if they were to move from that, as you described, the FBS being like the major bowl division, the main place where all of these schools play. And I'm curious, just, you know, in that respect, so if they were to make that shift, what would funding look like? I mean, what kind of impact would that have on the school? I mean, it seems like these schools have been able to remain relatively steady throughout the pandemic, but what would a change like that really mean for FIU?
Yeah, I mean, financially, you know, I tend to think that FIU is going to try to find a way to make it work, even if it means spending money, because, you know, they're in Miami. You know, we're the place in the country where there's more football talent than anywhere. You can't just, like, stop trying in football, even when it's not going well, because you can, you know, a couple of years ago, like I said, FIU beat Miami. But yeah, I mean, that's honestly, I think if they do drop down to FCS, which, you know, our Michelle Kaufman wrote a column in the Miami Herald this week saying prioritize football over football, basically because
soccer, for those who might not be initiated,
because you know, it's really expensive to run a football program, and I know that's been some of Butch Davis's issues with the way the program is going. You know, he was kind of grousing that they're not spending enough money. But the problem is, you know, their attendance figures are not good. You know, they were obviously the pandemic year hurt that. The year before, they were right around 15,000. I don't think they've reported them this year. Ultimately, it probably right now they're probably losing money on football. I don't have obviously all the figures right in front of me,
sure.
and they, you know, the schools can kind of fudge the numbers a little bit like anyone can, but yeah, I mean, it is it has a potential to be a big moneymaker for FIU, I think. Is the right now it's probably not a moneymaker, but it has a potential to be because of where they're located. Because, I mean, we all know how big of an alumni base they have. You know, that if they could become even FAU caliber, where it's, you know, it feels like they're in the Conference USA hunt every year, it would go a long way. But right now they're just far away from that. It's going to be hard, I think, to be financially solvent playing in one of these really small FBS conferences, unless you drop down to FCS and spend less money.
Definitely. Well, we'll have to definitely wait and see how that all shakes out. David Wilson with the Miami Herald, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And that'll do it for this week's edition of the South Florida Roundup. It's produced this week by Leslie Ovalle and Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre-Cohen. I'm WLRN's digital editor, Lance Dixon. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. And once again, I'm Lance, in for Tom Hudson this week. Thank you so much for calling and listening. Have a safe holiday. And this program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.
WLRN Public Media.